Pope John Paul II is generally considered to be a very popular pope, as evidenced by the enormous crowds which turned out to welcome him and pray with him in Philadelphia and other cities on his American visit. His outspoken support of solidarity in Poland has been received enthusiastically in America. But the pope has been criticized by many Americans for his lack of support of liberation movements in Latin America. He's alienated some American Catholics with his stand against the ordination of women, against the use of birth control, and against reforming the rule of priestly celibacy. I have two guests to discuss the Pope's religious and political views and how they are being received by Catholics in America and around the world. Leonard Swiedler is a professor of Catholic thought and interreligious dialogue at Temple University. He's the founding editor of the Journal of Ecumenical Studies. He's written extensively on the papacy, feminism in the Catholic Church, and interreligious dialogue. He recently wrote a critique of authority in contemporary Catholicism. Also with me is Monsignor John Foley, the editor of the Catholic Standard and Times, the weekly of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. He's also a professor of philosophy at St. Charles Seminary, press secretary for the U.S. Bishops' Meeting, and he was press secretary for Pope John Paul's trips through Ireland and America in 1979. He's also the English language secretary for the International Synod of Bishops. We're going to open up the telephones in a little while for any questions or comments that you have, and I'd like to welcome you both to Fresh Air. And to begin, I'd like to ask you each to sum up your views on Pope John Paul II and where you see him fitting into the history of the papacy. And Leonard Swiedler, let me ask you to begin.
Thanks very much. Well, first of all, I think you're right in saying that Pope John Paul II is clearly an extremely popular pope, as is indicated by these huge crowds. One of the very positive things about the present pope is his going out to the people, so that there's a clear, almost tangible sense that the papacy is not some faraway sort of bureaucratic institution, but it has flesh and blood, and in this instance, somebody who is a very magnetic kind of personality. In very brief fashion, beyond that, what I might characterize as sort of typical of what I can see in the present pope's reign to date is a sort of inside-outside, not contradiction, but close to it. On the outside, Pope John Paul II really seems to be very vigorous in pursuing what might be described as a kind of liberal position or policy. He is strong in support of social justice. He is strong in support of human rights in political action in various areas in the world. He is very supportive of the poor, and in general takes what I would describe as a liberal position in social justice and social political areas. On the other hand, concerning internal matters in the Catholic Church, he comes across as a very conservative, even close to authoritarian, centralizing kind of person. You see this in the kind of actions that are taken against well-known popular theologians like Hans Küng, Edward Skillebeck, and more recently Gutierrez, who is one of the liberation theologians in Latin America. And in this instance, these men are being called to task for their various theological positions. And in general, there seems to be a move to centralize authority inside the Catholic Church to restrict the kind of freedom of thought that was more characteristic of theological reflection in the first years after the Second Vatican Council. It's also reflected in what you've indicated about the call to religious nuns particularly to come back to older forms of outward behavior, putting on the habit and that sort of thing. We can talk about that more specifically later on. But it seems to me that here is what I see as one of the typical characteristics when it is a question of your power He's very liberal. When it's a question of my power, the Pope's in this case, then he's very conservative. And this is a kind of contradiction which I, as a Catholic, do not find very happy.
Now that's Leonard Swidler, and he's a professor of Catholic thought and interreligious dialogue at Temple University and the founding editor of the Journal of Ecumenical Studies. We're going to hear next from John P. Foley, Monsignor John Foley, who's the editor of the Catholic Standard and Times, the weekly of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. And how would you sum up the reign of Pope John Paul II to date?
Well, I think I'd use three P's. He's a philosopher, a pastor, and he's Polish. And each one of those, I think, has a real influence on what he does and how he acts. As a philosopher, he has a profound respect for the dignity of each individual. And he would see each individual as a child of God, as a unique creation of God, individually precious. And that leads to what you might call theological conservatism, or what you might call also essentialism. He would be theologically conservative in preserving that notion of individual dignity and the rights which flow from it, the right to life, the right to respect for the individual person, the right to organize, all of those things. And that flows into an aspect of being socially progressive, because once you see the inviolable, intrinsic, inherent dignity of each individual, then you say that what you have to do to put that into practice is be socially progressive and see that there is social progress, that there is respect for the rights of the poor, the opportunity for human development, for meaningful work in which individuals can express their personalities and contribute to the common good. Then, after his being a philosopher with all of that, all of what that entails, he's a pastor, preeminently a pastor. And this conviction he has of the dignity of each individual means that as the supreme pastor in the church, as the chief shepherd of the church, he wants to go out to his entire flock throughout the world and show his personal concern for them, whether it be to the sick, as he did in Lourdes just last week, whether it be to the poor, as he did in Mexico or in Central America, or whether it be to those who are not of the Catholic faith, as it was in Japan when he visited there and was received so warmly. There is this notion of the need to go out to preach the gospel message and to make himself available as a concerned shepherd. Now, in doing that, he has another aspect of protecting the flock from error. He would say that one of the tasks of a shepherd is to lead people safely to their heavenly destiny, their eternal destiny. And in order to do that, it has to be by the doctrine revealed by God, personified by Jesus Christ. And he would have the responsibility of protecting the flock from error. And that, I think, is the area to which Dr. Swidler referred. I think in the Pope's mind, I know in the Pope's mind, it's a question of communicating what he believes to be sound doctrine to those for whom he feels a profound sense of personal responsibility, and therefore warning against what seem to be dangers in regard to the interpretation of some church doctrine.
You're saying that in response to Dr. Swidler's comments about being authoritarian within the church and being more humanitarian outside of the church?
Yes. I would say if it would seem that he's authoritarian, what I would say is that he's exercising his authority as a responsibility to keep the flock from those theories which might ultimately be dangerous for them in regard to their eternal salvation. Now, I also said that he, by the way, on that, I think it's because he believes that clarity is the greatest charity. The greatest charity, concern, love you can show for people is to be clear in those guidelines which will determine what they do in their lives. The third point I mentioned is the fact that the Pope is Polish, and I think that that's had a great influence on him. One, he's the heir of a tremendous spiritual heritage. I think the highest level of religious practice in the world today would be found in Poland. There's a tremendous depth of faith. And he's also been tried in two crucibles. one of Nazism and the other of communism. He studied to be a priest while Poland was occupied by the Nazis, and when he saw that many of his friends arrested, he himself had been arrested, he helped to smuggle Jews out of Poland, and he has also been a priest, a bishop, a cardinal under the communists, in which it has required continuing effort to keep that some level of freedom of religious practice and some antidote to Marxist materialistic philosophy, to remind people that not by bread alone does man live, that our destiny is not in this world but in the next. So there has been that spiritual struggle throughout his life, and I think he sees that now with cosmic dimensions throughout the world.
Thierry, could I pick up right on that? I think that's absolutely right. At the same time, I think the Polish experience of the present pope also has, you might say, the weakness in its very strength, namely that his experience of the way one lives as a Catholic effectively comes out of that background. And so quite naturally, I think he tends to think of the world in world Catholicism in the same way. And you might describe his experience there as developing a sort of siege mentality, that the true believers are surrounded by enemies who are pressing at all on all sides, who always want to break down the resistance and the correct understanding of things, so that as a responsible leader, he feels he needs to protect them and he needs to maintain discipline, otherwise broken ranks are going to lead to disaster, all of which may be largely true in a situation like Poland. I would argue, and many others would argue, that that surely is not the case, however, in much of the rest of the world, and applying that kind of model has oftentimes very unhappy results.
Is there an example of the application of that model?
Well, the need for not breaking ranks, for everybody following the line that has been decided upon by the leaders, hierarchy or whatever, is understandable when you're under a siege. But when that's not the case, then what you do is you develop a kind of mentality which does not allow and does not foster each person to grow to his or her own full development, so that you have a kind of situation where, well, to use the old language of Holy Mother, the Church, then may tend to be not a good mother because it tends to keep the children children, whereas a good mother really wants to have the children grow into full adults who make their own decisions responsibly and take the consequences. And so those are two different models.
Well, Senior John Foley, I'd like to give you the chance to comment on that briefly before we get to the next subject.
Well, in regard to seeing the entire church from the Polish experience, there is an advantage to a certain extent in that, because the church has been quite successful in Poland. The seminaries are full. There's a high percentage of religious practice. And throughout the world, that has been eroding. There is a crisis in religious and priestly vocations in much of the world. The religious practice is diminishing in other areas of the world. And if you want to look to success stories, Poland is one of the big ones. So if he wants to reproduce some of the experiences from Poland, it's not out of nostalgia, but out of a realization that these methods have worked in a particular situation, and some of them may work elsewhere. For example, the notion of clerical attire, which is a disciplinary thing, there the idea is the visibility of the ministers of the church and how people can relate to them, find that they're available to them, and that there is a public witness to be given. In doctrinal matters, that's less debatable, because there you have the clarity of what he's required to do. He can change disciplinary matters. Doctrinal matters, he cannot change.
Well, since you've brought that up, let's talk about that. The Pope recently said that he'd like priests and nuns to return to the religious garb and to live in the seminary or in the convent. And I think that that was said in an attempt to have more people become members of the clergy or stay in the clergy. Dr. Swidler, do you think that that's applicable in a country like America if he is in fact as Monsignor Foley suggested, relying on his experience in Poland?
Well, from what I understand from many Catholic nuns in America, it won't work. I mean, they're not going to go home again, so to speak, and they're not going to simply have dictation given to them as far as their habits. There may be a confrontation that will develop out of it, and this would be very unhappy, really unfortunate in my judgment. It seems to me that a really good leader is someone who can be, as it were, out in front and persuade people they should do this or that, rather than using force of one sort or another. Also, it seems to me in this kind of a situation, we are dealing with a very, very multifarious kind of body of people. The situation in Western Europe and in America is vastly different from behind the Iron Curtain. For example, true, there is a lot of quote-unquote religious activity in Poland. How much of it is on a rather primitive level? How much of it is very reflective and profound? How much of it may be a means of political protest? The very fact that you put on a clerical garb in Poland means you're thumbing your nose at the Communist Party. That's one very effective way of doing it. All you have to do is pull your rosary out and you're thumbing your nose at the Communist Party. And there, of course, understandably, are all sorts of Poles who would like nothing better than to thumb their nose at the Communist Party. Right behind them, of course, stand the Russians, and there's no one that the Poles dislike more than the Russians. So it's a very complex kind of thing. And then simply to take that pattern and to try to transfer it to Western Germany, France, even Latin America, United States, it's just not going to work effectively.
Do you think it's going to work in America?
Well, I don't think it's as simple as that. I would agree with Dr. Swidler that a good leader is out in front, and that's where Pope John Paul comes through his trips, his pastoral visits throughout the world, in order to attempt to identify with the people, and he has been wildly popular on those trips, and to attempt to articulate what they realize to be true many times. They accept it as coming from him, and at other times they may have been confused by mixed signals or uncertain trumpets. So there has been, on his trips, a great enthusiasm and sense of identification with him and what he says. Now, in regard to the other part about force, I would agree that it's unfortunate if there is a confrontation or if there is the appearance of force, although sometimes good morals or good discipline, like good art, begin by drawing a line, and somebody's going to disagree about where you draw the line. But ultimately, somebody has to draw the line somewhere, and that's where perhaps there will be tension. I would hope there wouldn't be tragic confrontation.
Well, it seems that one of the places where there's the possibility of some serious rebellion now is within the movement of nuns, who many of whom are disappointed in Pope John Paul II's policy against the ordination of women. What effect do you think that is having on American clergy?
On regard to the question of the ordination of women, it seems to me that you have a doctrinal issue involved, and the doctrinal issue is, do we have any evidence in sacred scripture that Jesus did say that women could be ordained to the ministerial priesthood, or do you have any evidence, sound evidence, in the 2,000-year history of the tradition of the Church, the understanding of what Christ revealed, that women could be ordained? I don't see anything intrinsically impossible in having women ordained, but the question is, what did Christ want? What did he reveal? What has the Church understood that he revealed? And the documents from the Vatican are very careful. They say, we do not consider ourselves authorized to have the ordination of women. So in that case, they're saying it's a doctrinal question, and we have to see the doctrinal evidence which would permit it before we could do so. Now, there are other problems in regard to members of religious communities apart from the ordination of women. I think the Pope is concerned with the tremendous drop in the number of women in religious communities in the United States. 10 years ago, you had 180,000. Now you have 120,000. The Catholic population is increasing. The needs still seem to be there in traditional areas in which members of religious communities have been involved in operating schools, in operating charitable institutions and agencies. And yet the number of religious vocations is declining greatly, and there seems to be a disintegration of the discipline, the coordinated apostolic efforts which previously existed. So the Pope, as responsible for the entire church throughout the world, sees, in a sense, part of this apostolic effort throughout the world crumbling and disintegrating, and it's understandable that he would be concerned. How best to respond to that is the question. Can there be a greater diversity in the types of apostolate that women and men do? That's one aspect and certainly is valid. But also, does it not need to be in some ways a coordinated apostolic effort so that there is a vision of what is being done and so that individuals are cooperative within that vision rather than confrontational or divisive? And I think that's the real issue in regard to, let's say, the Pope and the authority of the church and the members of religious communities. How best that sense of collaboration, of shared apostolic responsibility, can be worked out.
I'd second what Monsignor Foley has said and comment further, specifically initially on the question of the ordination of women, that as he indicated, the Vatican document, there is a single document that came out late 1977, on the question of ordination of women and took a negative stance. But it was carefully phrased. It did not, in a way, really close the door, but rather said, as Monsignor Foley indicated, that we don't see how, in fact, we can proceed to ordain women. The implication being that if and when the authorities are persuaded by evidence, arguments, then they can proceed. As far as the biblical materials are concerned, that document pretty well, I think, kind of says, well, the evidence really is not persuasive in a negative sort of way. In terms of positive evidence, as far as the Bible is concerned, well, there's no indication that Jesus ordained anybody. The question of a priestly ordination as we have it now is something that developed in the early church. But I think the real reason is, as is indicated in that document, the tradition. And the tradition has been they have understood that Jesus could have ordained women if he wanted to, he didn't, and therefore they conclude that there apparently must be some reason not to. I think that's a faulty conclusion. There's an undistributed middle there, I think. But at any rate, I think they left the door open. So that whoever is Pope in the future, it seems to me, could quite, in quite traditional fashion, move to have the ordination of women be okayed. Now, on the second matter of women religious in general, and the drop in the number and the Pope's concern about the supposed or alleged eroding of discipline, it's true the number has dropped. The number of priests in the world has dropped dramatically, too. It's also true that many of the tasks that were carried out by these religious and priests have been taken over by lay people, for example, in the teaching of Catholic schools in this country. And they appear, in many instances, to do quite good jobs. They can be quite as dedicated as a religious person. And so what we may be coming into is a much more differentiated kind of body of active Christians, Catholic Christians, which is not a bad thing.
You could make the argument that if there are less women who are becoming nuns, that might be possibly that might be because there's more options for women. Women have the choice of many different jobs and many different ways of leading their life than they did before. Do you think it's fair to assume that by making the church more conservative, that more people will be attracted to it? Because that seems, Monsignor Foley, from what you're saying, to be the Pope's assumption.
I don't think is the church being made more conservative, because there are various problems in the world which are being confronted by the church, whether it's in the area of communications, in the area of labor relations. For example, the Pope's encyclical letter, the letter addressed to all the bishops of the world, Laborem Exercens, in which he says that individuals have a right and a responsibility to organize. I would view that not as a conservative, but as a very progressive stand. So I don't think it's fair to say that the Pope is attempting to make the church more conservative. I would say that it would probably be fair to say that he's attempting to call it to fidelity to its essential principles, to fidelity to Christ, fidelity to the doctrines of the church as reflective of the revelation of Christ. If you want to call that conservative, I guess you can, insofar as conservatism is preserving what is considered to be essential. But there are, I guess, implications to the term conservative. Some people view that as reactionary or as going behind a stone wall and peering out over the edge of the wall at people who were invading. And I think the Pope's idea is to go out into the world to spread the gospel, to evangelize. But in order to do that, there has to be a clear vision of what it is we are proclaiming, and therefore you have to have doctrinal clarity, and a clear area of responsibility for what areas, what works individuals will be doing, so that there is some coordination of effort, some true mutual collaboration and responsibility, and that's the area of discipline.
I'd like to add a comment. I think this is a very critical area, this notion of doctrinal clarity, how one gets it, how much clarity does one need to be effective, how much clarity can one in fact really have, or when does it become only an apparent kind of clarity. Earlier, Monsignor Foley used an interesting image about, well, something like an arch, you have to draw a line to start. Well, that's an interesting image, but I'd like to suggest that maybe you don't have to draw a line when you talk about even this question of doctrine. I don't know that that's the most helpful model. It seems to me, especially in the contemporary scene, that the way to deal with what is the best, most helpful way to express certain doctrines in the church is by way of dialogue rather than some body of people, an individual or a group of people, deciding this is the truth and everybody has to meet that minimum standard. It seems to me that we now are becoming more and more aware of the variety of ways of understanding and expressing things which are influenced by a full range of events, circumstances, and depending upon, among other things, where you stand in society, whether you're male or female, poor or rich, educated in this culture or in that culture. All of these things have a very profound bearing on how you perceive things and express them. Therefore, the most helpful way to get to the best kind of expression of a doctrine in a particular time and place is by way of dialogue. I would see the office of the papacy and its congregations in this regard, the Holy Office or the Congregation for the Teaching of the Faith, as having the function of pulling together people in dialogue and keeping them in dialogue until they get the best possible expression at a particular time, rather than drawing lines.
I'd like to invite our listeners to join in this conversation with your questions or comments. We're discussing Pope John Paul II, and I have two guests with me just speaking with Dr. Leonard Swidler, who's a professor of Catholic thought and interreligious dialogue at Temple University. He's also the founding editor of the Journal of Ecumenical Studies. Also with me is Monsignor John Foley, who is also a professor of philosophy at St. Charles Seminary, as well as the editor of the Catholic Standard and Times, the weekly of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. If you have any questions or comments, our number is 923-2774. We're at area code 215. The number again is 923-2774.
While people are waiting to call, if I may just say something in regard to that question of religious truth. The Pope is a philosopher, as I already pointed out, And I think he's very aware of the fact that truth must be couched in language, and that's an area where there is a great deal of debate. Is language today the same as it was? Are the terms in which we defined things the same terms that are used today? And he's also very aware of the idea of culture. I was president at the Synod of Bishops when people were talking about the family. Are the same, are family customs in Africa valid? And they were distinguishing between things like polygamy and fidelity through life and all of those areas, which are most important. So I do think he's aware of those areas, certainly.
Without risking trivializing the subjects, I'd like to, there's a few more subjects I'd like to get in before the close of our show today. The next is the issue of birth control. The Pope is opposed to the use of birth control, and I know from surveys that many Catholic women feel that it should be all right for Catholics to use birth control. Do you think that policy is going to end up backfiring in a place like America, in which the women's movement has progressed greatly over the past 15 years? Either of you like to take that?
Well, I don't. My judgment is you're talking about a historical fact that has backfired, and has been a good deal of sociological evidence to indicate that that has been a major source of the loss of credibility vis-a-vis the leadership of the Catholic Church. Most unfortunate, in my judgment. I would point out also that in the late 1960s, Pope Paul VI appointed a committee to look into the whole matter of birth control, to report back to him, and there were about 100 people on it eventually, which committee did report, and my recollection is there was something like 95% voted in favor of allowing artificial birth control under certain circumstances. And there was a very small group, about 5%, which put in a minority report. Their argument was not on the so much on the evidence, but rather sort of because you have already spoken, you, the papacy, back in the 1930s, Pius XI, therefore to change your position would be to destroy the credibility of the authority of the papacy. Therefore, you must maintain the same position. My response to that would be, of course, it's exactly wrong. I mean, exactly the opposite happened. But in any case, that's the argument that was put forward in rather simplified fashion. And Pope Paul VI apparently accepted that and then issued his document in 1968. What I think is an even further sad commentary is that traditionally, in Roman Catholic moral theology, even before the Second Vatican Council, it has been taught by way of the theory of probabilism that if a minority but nevertheless a number of reputable moral theologians uphold a particular moral position, then if you are similarly persuaded, you may, in good conscience, follow that position, even though, let's say, only 15% of the moral theologians take that position. Now, in this particular instance, so far as I can tell, of the publishing moral theologians, the vast majority, like over three quarters, in fact, favor the possibility of following artificial birth control. What I find really very disturbing is that a lot of bishops will say that you may not, in good conscience, practice birth control as a Catholic. As a matter of fact, they had the very same classes that I had in probabilism and moral theology, and they know very well that they can't say that. They can issue an order in obedience, but they also have to say that if your conscience dictates other than that, then you may, in good conscience, practice birth control. And they don't say that, and I think that's a terrible shame.
Well, I have to disagree with Dr. Schwidler in a number of areas. I, for one, when Pope Paul VI issued his encyclical Letter Humanae Vitae on human life, which said that every act within marriage must remain open to the transmission of life and therefore ruled out artificial contraception, I rejoiced because I said to myself, there is this consistency with the continuing teaching of the Church, but also, and more important, he said that if you separate the life-giving aspect of the expression of sexual love from its love-giving aspect, if you're engaging in sexual activity out of the context of the transmission of human life, then ultimately you're going to be justifying every type of sexual aberration, and there will be a call for abortions if life happens to have been transmitted. There will be a call for the justification of premarital sexual activity, extramarital sexual activity, homosexual activity. And people in 1968 said, oh, no, that will never happen. But we've seen all of that happen. So I would say that morality is not determined by a sociological poll. 40 million Frenchmen or Americans can be wrong. And I would also contest Dr. Swidler's point regarding what he called the notion of probabilism, that if a number of moral theologians would teach something, then you could safely follow it. That was not true if the church had issued an official teaching on the matter, which the church has done in 1968 in the document Humanae Vitae. So I would say that that particular position would not be valid in this case. That is valid in cases where there are contested matters. Of course, the individual must always follow his or her conscience. I would hope that consciences would be correctly formed.
How do you think practicality should enter into an issue like birth control? If a woman, for instance, works to help support her family, she has the choice of either having to stop working every few months to have a baby, and then she'd really be caught in the syndrome of having to work more to support more children, but she wouldn't be able to work because there'd be more children at home to take care of. Or she could abstain from having sex with her husband, which would be a very problematical thing for both her and her husband. And I could envision a possibility where you're getting pressure from your husband to engage in sexual relations as well as your own desire to do it, but pressure from your church to say, but if you do that, you have to bear children every 9 months if you're fertile.
Oh, no, they wouldn't say that. The regular periods of infertility, of course, and there are courses in natural family planning. And there are the problems that have occurred, even many women in the women's movement have said there are problems that have occurred with artificial contraception. And they say, why should women bear the burden for this? Because you have greater danger, possibility of heart attack or some types of cancer or something like that. But I'm not going to get into that particular aspect now. The essential point is that Pope Paul VI said, and I agree, that every act within marriage must remain open, potentially open to the transmission of life. That doesn't mean you're obliged to have children every year, and it doesn't mean that you're obliged to abstain permanently from sexual activity. Periodic continence, which is possible and necessary sometimes when partners are absent from one another, when one or other may be sick. Love can sometimes be expressed more effectively in that way, although I won't deny that there are tensions in that, as there are in keeping all types of moral requirements.
I would think that one of the basic questions is, on what grounds does one make the assertion that every sexual act must be open to the transmission of life? I mean, it does not at all seem apparent to me that that must be the case. That simply, I would think, is a gratuitous assumption. You can't assume that. You have to argue it. And I don't think it's been argued. At least I haven't heard it persuasively argued.
If you're just joining us, I have two guests with me. Just speaking with Dr. Lynette Swidler, professor of Catholic thought and interreligious dialogue at Temple University, and also the founding editor of the Journal of Ecumenical Studies. Speaking just before him was Monsignor John Foley, who is a professor of philosophy at St. Charles Seminary and the editor of the Catholic Standard and Times, the weekly of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. And we're discussing the religious and political policies of Pope John Paul II. And before we get to the phones, I know we're trying to squeeze a lot into this hour, but I'd like to get to his political views. And I'd like to ask you to compare Pope John's political policies in Poland with his political stance in Latin America, which I think are the two parts of the globe in which his politics have been most evident.
All right, if I may preface my remark by saying I don't think the idea of every act remaining open to the transmission of life is a gratuitous assertion, but is tied in to the notion of the purpose for sexual differentiation and the notion of the sexual faculties as primarily reproductive. So that's why the assertion isn't gratuitous, even though it may be contested. The point about Pope John Paul and his attitude toward the government in Poland, you might say, and in Central America, I think is consistent. There has been a consistent articulation of the notion of human rights, also of the notion of religious liberty, the right for the church to exercise its function in Poland and in Central America. And also, I guess what you're thinking here is, what about the idea of political involvement by the church or by individual clerics? It's been the position of the Pope, as I understand it, that the church is required to speak in certain areas, on certain issues of matters of principle, but to become involved with a particular political party, which would embrace in a number of issues with which the church possibly would not wish to be identified, compromises the doctrinal integrity of the church and the effectiveness of the church. For example, if I were to run for Congress, as has been done by some priests in some places, then am I, as a priest of the church and identified as such, in a sense, identifying the church with the Democratic Party or with the Republican Party or with the entire program of either of those parties, and perhaps seeming to bring a moral force behind certain positions which those positions might not deserve? Would I be misleading people, possibly, and also compromising the church as an institution by doing that, and possibly undermining the effect of its prophetic utterance in certain areas where it would be expected to speak clearly and forcefully? So the Pope, I would say, is issue-oriented rather than politically-oriented, and has asked that priests abstain from specific political activity with political organizations, so that that clarity of vision is not lost.
I'd just like to comment with some questions rather than assertions. I would question our use, I don't mean in this room, I mean just in general, our use of the term the church in the way that we do very often. What tends to happen is the church gets boiled down to maybe the Pope or the hierarchy or the clergy, something of that sort. And that's a very narrow view. So, for example, earlier Monsignor Foley was talking about probabilism not obtaining in a situation where the church has made a decision. In that instance, I think you really meant the Pope had issued a document, namely Humanae Vitae. I still think that afterwards that has been contested by moral theologians, and I think good Jesuit training would indicate to me that the probabilism still applies. But nevertheless, the point here is that I think we need to be much more careful in our use of the word the church. I mean, I too am part of the church, and that's a very important thing to keep in mind. I would like to use more precise language like the leaders of the church or the hierarchy or the papacy or whatever it happens to be, rather than a blanket kind of statement. There's a certain kind of irony, it seems to me, in the present kind of situation of the papacy's stand on political involvement on the part of clergy and other official persons in the church, when one thinks of the fact, remembers the fact that the Pope for over 1,000 years was head of state up until just slightly over 100 years ago, when bishops and cardinals were princes and thought nothing of it. There's a certain kind of irony in that, as long, it seems, historically, as long as the political leaders were autocrats of one sort or another, then it seemed to be all right for the bishops, popes, priests, and so on to be political leaders. But as soon as they get to be democratic, then it becomes a no-no. One becomes slightly suspicious. Now, one of the criticisms that also, I think, is raised toward the present Pope is that his involvement in Poland, although maybe on the formal level, keeps a kind of distinction between church and state, It's also very clear that his visits there and the involvements of Cardinal Glemp and so on are highly political and to the nth degree. And then to go down to Latin America and say to the priest Cardinal, you mustn't be involved, is very puzzling. There seems to be a kind of forked tongue kind of language going on here. Also, it's puzzling that it's all right, it seems, for a cleric to have an appointive position in a government, but not an elective one. Why would that be? I should think an elective one would put even more restraints on the person, give the person more concern for the people, whereas an appointive position, you need only be responsible to your boss, whoever appointed you, who could then disappoint you. Now, I don't want to take a position, but these are all very puzzling and disturbing questions I would raise.
Well, it's an interesting point. I would say regarding the historic relationship of church and state that perhaps in this area, and this is a very human area, the church has learned a lesson. I don't think the church was strengthened when clerics exercised temporal power, but was rather weakened. And it's from that lesson of seeing the weakening of the church through the exercise of temporal power by clerics that has made the church today say, no exercise of temporal power by clerics. And in fact, some of the clerics that are most in the spotlight today are those in Nicaragua who are appointed to those positions and not elected, and the church has said, please leave those positions, and if you don't, then you can't exercise your priesthood during the time that you're in those positions, so that the position of the church is not compromised by their exercise of temporal power. So I think if in any area the church has learned its lesson, is that clerics should not exercise temporal responsibility. It was a disaster in the past, and it's not too happy when it's done now.
I would agree with you there. Do you think maybe that, as you indicate, that this approach of asking, in this case, priests, to take a leave of absence if they're going to exercise some kind of political position might be one way of resolving the matter?
I don't think so, ultimately, because my feeling is that they really should have resigned those offices. Personally, I feel that way. And that the other is an unfortunate type of compromise which muddies the waters in any case. They're still viewed as priests, as they are, and the answer I don't think has been a happy one, nor I know does the Pope consider it a happy one.
In America, the church, you could say, is very active in politics, even if it's not necessarily through priests or nuns being elected to office.
On particular issues, as
right,
in
on,
a recent pastoral letter on war and peace, for example.
Right, and on the issue of abortion, on several other issues as well. What do you think the church's role should be in that kind of lobbying or in editorializing on issues?
Well, of course, the church has a responsibility to articulate what would be considered moral positions. That's part of its prophetic role. It must do that. And if that involves attempting to convince individuals generally, and if you want to call that lobbying, then you can do that, I suppose. But it's a moral stance of attempting to educate, to lead, to form consciences ultimately. And that's what the church is trying to do. If that results in positions which are taken by governments as a response to such moral leadership, then I think we should rejoice in the fact that governments would respond to the articulation of moral leadership.
Perhaps one of the things that will help to resolve the difficulties is what I was referring to earlier, an increasing nuancing of the involvement of different groups of people in different roles in the exercise of functions inside the church. We are the heirs of a tradition which sort of has almost everything being done on by clerics and religious, and then the recipients being lay people. That's been changing since the Second Vatican Council. It seems to me if and when that continues to change, that there isn't going to be this clear demarcation that this group of people may exercise political powers and this group of people may not. I think that that kind of answer is an answer to a question that is not going to be asked very much longer.
Well, we're running out of time, so let me ask you in the remaining couple of minutes to sum up for us, what direction do you think the Pope is leading the Catholic Church? Leonard Swidler?
Well,
it's a big question for a short amount of time.
Well, not only that, I mean, if I really knew, I could make $1 million, among other things. First of all, I've been basically rather critical in my remarks today. I've understood that that, in a sense, was my role and expected of me, and I hope I haven't disappointed you. and John, you've played your role, too. The fact of the matter is, however, as far as I'm concerned, I think that the present Pope, as I indicated only very briefly, has an immense amount of capacity for leadership in the present world situation. The world obviously is just dying of thirst for real leadership, and so the Pope responds to that, and people respond to him. I am deeply disappointed, as I've indicated, that this leadership, I think, tends to be following a kind of double standard. Out there, when it's the outside, your power, he's great. But inside, when it concerns his power, I think he's not great. And not only is that bad for the people inside, it's bad for the people outside because it destroys the credibility of his image on the outside.
Monsignor Foley?
Well, I think the direction that the Pope is going in is to try to obtain on the temporal level peace through justice, reminding people of their responsibility to work for justice and to defend human rights. I would think also that he is calling for accountability on the part of those who are the official representatives of the Church. That would be bishops, priests, members of religious communities. And it wouldn't be my opinion that he's acting arbitrarily, but responsibly in expecting them to be accountable for the exercise of their ministry in a church which is truly one and Catholic or universal, that it is a hierarchical church. We are all members of the church. We all have our individual responsibilities, but we're all members of the one body of Christ, and there is to be expected some unity in a sense that unity is symbolized by the Pope as, we would say, the vicar of Christ, the representative of Christ in the direction of the Church. And he has the ultimate responsibility for attempting to maintain that unity and see that it is expressed through the public representatives of the Church. Where is the Pope leading the Church? I would hope to a greater sense of internal unity and to external effectiveness in the work for peace and justice and ultimately, I would say, universal love. That's my dream, that's my hope, and I think that's the hope and prayer of the Pope as well.
I want to thank you both for spending this past hour with us, and I send my sincere regrets to those people who have been holding on the telephone. We really ran out of time. I think we tried to cover a lot in the past hour and consequently didn't have enough time to get in the phone call. So again, I apologize to those of you who have been holding on the phone. We've been talking about Pope John Paul II, and just speaking was Monsignor John Foley, the editor of the Catholic Standard and Times, the weekly of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. He's also a professor of philosophy at St. Charles Seminary, and he was the press secretary for Pope John Paul during his trips through Ireland and America in 1979. Also with me has been Dr. Leonard Swidler, a professor of Catholic thought and interreligious dialogue at Temple University. He's also the founding editor of the Journal of Ecumenical Studies. He's written extensively on the papacy, on feminism and the Catholic Church, and interreligious dialogue. Again, my thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.